The Escoffier series continues with the part two of the fish chapter, which is chapter six. The shellfish portion contains less than you might expect from a chef like Escoffier. This episode is going to cover crab and lobster and shrimp and scallops mostly, and a few others added to the pot, so to speak. This is, in part, an audio tutorial about cleaning some types of shellfish. Now, I realize that listening to how to do it isn't the same as doing it, but I think it's a good start. The Eating Liberty Podcast, episode 230, Food and Freedom Once a Week for Life. Hello, folks. Stan Reed here. We're just diving in today, so let's go. It's part two of the fish chapter of the Escoffier series, and this is the seafood part. As this chapter goes, there is fish and then not fish. The not fish are clams and mussels and oysters, of course, and lobster and sea urchins and turtles and snails, and one recipe for crab, and one recipe for frog's legs. I'm not going to talk about frog's legs. Let's get the crab dish out of the way with an introduction to a little bit of crab fisherman, I guess crab crabber information. My wife bought some Dungeness crabs last week. Now, that's a big deal out here on the Pacific Coast, maybe kind of like how blues are a big deal on the West Coast, or stone crab claws in Florida. The crab she bought was cooked. Each leg side, all five legs, which includes the claw, yes, crab have 10 legs, not 8, was attached to the body that remains after cleaning. Crabs have parts most people don't see when they buy, say, king crab legs at the store. The outer shell part of the body called the carapace, and I probably mispronounced that, that's the outer hard shell part that you see on top. Crabs have a piece called the apron, which is on the underside. Some places that might be called the plate, which folds under the crab. Now, it actually serves to gender identify the crab, and you would pick the she crabs from the he crabs, and that's how you make she crab soup. So, and there's no politics in soup. Crabs have gills, which you can't see until you remove the shell. There is an exception with soft-shelled crabs, which I'll get into in a little bit. And then there remains under the shell, the carapace, jaws to remove those. Now, except for soft shell crabs, I've never seen live hard shell crabs before. I know from cleaning the soft shell crabs that the crab has what Escoffier calls the creamy parts. Part of that creamy bit is the tamale, which is the same greenish, looks like green brains inside of the lobster. If the crab is a she crab, there will be a red or bright orange parts too called the coral. And you will also find coral in female lobsters. Now, the tamale and the coral are edible, and in a she crab soup, the coral is really going to make the difference. Escoffier would take the tamale and the coral, mix them together with a little bit of vinegar, a little bit of mustard, and kind of make a bit of a mayonnaise out of that. Pass that through a sieve to get out parts you don't want and use that as a flavoring / binding agent, which we're going to come to in just a minute here. Back to the crab cleaning. After you remove the shell, the apron or the plate, and give the crab a bit of a rinse, what remains is the underpart. The legs attached to this cartilaginous, is that even a word, mass, with loads of meat. The meat in those cartilage cavities is called lump back fin meat, maybe just back fin meat, and sometimes the terms are confusing. and is very good for crab cakes. Now, I don't know enough about crab anatomy to say that a blue crab and a Dungeness crab and a king crab are fundamentally the same except for the name, so everything on one is the same as everything on the other. But on the blue crab, the very back little legs, which don't amount to very much, that's where on the sort of next to the body, that's where the jumbo lump meat comes from. Each crab has two. And so getting a pint of those things takes a lot of crabs. And that's one of the reasons that jumbo lump crab meat can be really expensive. And of course, another reason is that it's actual human labor and not robots doing that work. But that's an aside. So these leg things that I had at home, this weird looking crab spider, they were split. So one set of five legs had its half of its undercarriage body and meat attached, and then the other side had that. Oh, and I will put a link on the show notes page for a crab cake recipe, which, if I do say so myself, I didn't invent it. Got that from the Governor's Club in Tallahassee, but it is a pretty stinking good one. And the main reason it's so good is because it has just a little bit of breadcrumbs to bind. It isn't breadcrumb cake with crab garnish. This is good stuff. Now, getting through all of that shell and tamale and coral stuff, all that was to explain what it was that we bought, which was the legs and the body part. One of the things that I was kind of curious about was, since we got them cooked, is there some rule about having to cook them right away? So I asked the only guy I know who knows that, and that's Matt McCrellis from Southern Seafood in Tallahassee. He's been on the show. He's a fish guy. So I asked him, when crabbers catch crabs, do they have to cook them immediately? Is there some like rule about that? He told me that crabbers will cook the crabs when they get back to shore, since the quality of the meat deteriorates rapidly. So this ensures a good product for the consumer, and it ensures a quality catch for the crabber. Now, the soft shell crab is a single exception to all of this, and the soft shell crab is a crab that has molted. Crab shells don't grow. Crabs do grow. In order for the crab to grow, it has to shed its shell and form a new one. Now, in the South, where this is a big deal, soft shell blue crabs are held in tanks. Now, I don't know how big these tanks are, but they are watched. When season time comes, crabbers put the blues in the tanks and they wait for the crab to molt. And as soon as it sort of, you know, it sort of fills its shell with a bunch of water and releases itself from its own shell and sort of backs out of its old home. And when it does that, now it is a soft shell crab. It has, well, it's obviously not as hard. If this is a new idea to you, it can sound kind of crazy that this organism doesn't actually have an exoskeleton. It's just this thing. It's not shell-less, but it isn't hard, and it's going to take a couple of days for it to start to form that hard shell. As soon as it molts, and in between the molting and the day or two it takes for that shell to start to get hard, it in its form is edible. And so when you buy a soft shell crab, that's what you're getting. So when it molts, the crabber will take it out of there and put it with a whole bunch of other ones that molt, and they'll sell that to fishmongers, which will then sell it to restaurants, and then maybe you'll go eat it. So the cleaning of the soft shell, we're just going to go through this real quick. So since the shell doesn't exist, it stays on. Where the little pointy parts are on a blue that sort of, that part of the shell will sort of lift up, and that's what the gills are. The gills have to come off. There's an old wives' tale about them being, I don't know, deadly or poisonous. They don't taste very good. They'll be bitter, and what's the point of eating that? They don't digest. They don't. There's no reason to eat them, so don't eat them. And then take off the apron, and then, well, there's no delicate way to say this. You cut off the eyeballs. If there's a coral in there, there won't be a coral. If there's a tamale in there, and there will be, that's going to stay inside the crab. But so the lungs, the apron, and the face comes off. Now that, as it is, will be probably sautéed. Deep frying soft shell crabs is doable, but my goodness, it's going to spit a lot because there's a whole lot of water in those things. And water inside of a deep fryer is a recipe for disaster. So we never deep fried them. Breaded them, pan fried them, made sandwiches out of them, just did all kinds of things. And quite honestly, I was never overwhelmed. But maybe that's just me. So all that stuff about crabs gets to Escoffier's one recipe for crabs. And it reads, detach the claws and small legs. Break the claws, remove the flesh, and reserve. Pull the breast away from the carapace and remove any white flesh, adding it to the already reserved from the claws. Extract the creamy parts and place this in a basin. After passing it through a fine sieve, add a little mustard and a touch of cayenne to this puree and mix it in a little vinegar and oil so as to thicken it like a mayonnaise. Break up the reserved flesh and add to the prepared creamy parts. Clean and dry the shell and fill it with the prepared mixture. Smooth the surface and decorate to choice with chopped parsley, lobster coral, and chopped hard-boiled white and yolk of egg. Place on a folded serviette on a suitable dish and serve it in place with the small legs, which are removed at the beginning. So all of that, one recipe, is to make crab salad and put it back on the shell. So it doesn't sound bad, but it's a simple recipe. It's a bit of a work, but it's not hard. Crayfish, shrimps, prawns, and lobsters are whole animals. That means they eat. And that means they poop. That means part of their anatomy needs to be removed. The polite term for the intestine in lobsters and shrimp is the vein. It does sound a whole lot nicer than the poop chute. Escoffier describes the process of removing the vein from a crayfish as being important, and it is, and necessary almost immediately before cooking, as opposed to removing it a few days prior. The caution for removing the vein too soon is, quote, it is essential that the operation of removing the gut is carried out immediately prior to cooking. If left for any length of time before cooking, the juices of the crayfish tend to leak out from the wound and finally leave the shell empty, end quote. Now, what he means, it's not entirely clear. If you take out the gut and then let the crayfish sit for a couple of days, the tail meat just leaks out. The wound is how and where the gut was removed. Now, if you've seen crayfish, and the crayfish and shrimp tails and lobsters and langoustines, and they all sort of royal reds or kind of shrimp, they all sort of look basically the same. Under the middle fin, at the end of the tail, you can you can see where the vein comes out. Now, he writes to use the tip of a paring knife and your thumb to grab a hold of that vein, that gut, and pull it out. Now, guts that are left in crayfish might impart a bitter flavor or bitter taste to the meat. Additionally, guts left in meat is gross. Now, shrimp are frequently sold shell on and gut intact. The process for cleaning shrimp is simple enough. There are tools made for deveining and shelling at the same time. The shells can be removed. There's a couple ways to do that, but the easiest way mostly is pull off the legs and spread the shell apart, and the shrimp mostly comes out. It's a little bit of work. And then with this shelled shrimp tail in your hand, I'm right-handed, so I would hold the shrimp. So the body end is the fat round part, and the tail end, of course, is the tapered end. So I'd hold the body end between my thumb and forefinger, and with a paring knife, slice just the top of the shrimp to get into its body, and then that's where the vein is going to be. Now, sometimes there's coral in there, there's some other stuff in there. Usually it looks like fat. Leave it in, leave it out. But the main thing to get out of there is that vein, and almost always it's going to look like this little tube of dirt. It's not dirt. Lobsters have a vein, but there's an interesting thing. The lobsters are carnivores, and they'll eat the dead lobsters in the tank, which is why you don't very often see dead lobsters in tanks, is because they take them out. The humans take them out because they don't want the lobsters eating them, because lobster veins generally in tanks, the lobsters are they're pretty clean. But if you see it, take it out. Cooking crayfish or shrimp or lobster, according to the times given on the various recipes in this chapter, seems to me excessive. It's quite possible we've been eating overcooked shrimp forever and didn't know it. It's quite possible that restaurants overcook it as a general rule, especially deep fried stuff. Overcooked lobster is easier to notice because it gets stringy. Now, I want to clarify, and that's not a butter joke, that the lobster escoffier means, when he says lobster, is what we call a Maine lobster. He does mention langoustines. Other lobsters are available, not mentioned in the book, but there are some very nice lobsters to have and some that I would avoid entirely. The one I would avoid entirely is called slipper lobster. Generally, they're puny little tails. I think they're absolutely terrible. The meat doesn't have a lot of flavor. It shrinks tremendously and is nowhere near the value for the price. Bulldozer lobsters, which you probably never heard of and probably will never see, are not found anywhere that I know of except for the Gulf of Mexico. And I think they're fairly deep. The Gulf isn't that deep, but they're out there a bit, and they aren't pretty, and they don't have claws. So there's nothing really redeeming about them except that through the very hard, tough shell, much harder than a Maine's shell, rests some spectacular tail meat, which to me rivals the Maine lobster for flavor. And actually, on a yield test, it's about the same bulldozer to Maine, but I thought they were very good. So we use them a lot for the garnish for the lobster bisque. So there are other kinds of lobster out there. They are all going to cook about the same amount of time. Oh, and the other one that you'd get would be in the Keys would be the spiny lobster. And boy, howdy, those things are spiny. They're like weapons. Lots of meat in the tail. They have claws technically, but there isn't a lot really there to get out. But spiny lobster is fantastic and does not really taste. It tastes like lobster, but it's not the same as Maine. And to me, it lends itself to an entirely different application. So I would think things like curry and cilantro, coconut milk, spicy heat, lots of tomatoes, some tomatillos. There's more of a Caribbean mindset because they're not cold water lobsters, they're warm water lobsters. And just in that whole environment of what's available in Cuba and the various islands down there and Jamaica and Haiti and even South Florida, there's just so much other possibilities that seems to fit. What is important in all cases is that the lobster is cooked sooner rather than later. I've seen restaurant in Naples, we got them in season. We got lots of them. So we prepped them, we cut them in half, laid them on the sheet tray, and we had a whole bunch of these things and sold them maybe within 2 days and sold them grilled. And I forgot what the sauce was. But even after the second day, the quality of that meat is starting to lose its beauty and it starts to get a little bit black. So if you fresh anything, shrimp, langoustines, lobsters, spiny lobsters, get it fresh, cook it right away. Once it's cooked, the lobster meat now has a new clock on it because it's been cooked, so you have a little bit of time. But cook fresh food quickly, especially shelled shellfish. It sounds kind of repetitive. Fresh frozen lobster can stay frozen, but once it's thawed, it should be cooked. So it should be cooked. How long is a spectacularly good question. Now, I mentioned that in some cases, Escoffier writes to cook lobster pieces 15 to 20 minutes. That seems way too long. A better way to determine doneness for lobster is to take its temperature. Lobster meat's done at about 140 degrees. Now, that's way less than pretty much anything else you use to cooking. It's certainly way less than chicken or even reheated beef. Keep in mind that any lobster piece that will have a sauce with it, or lobster pieces that are in a sauce, like lobster Newburgh, the meat will continue to cook. So even like a Newburgh, you're starting with raw. Well, there's two ways, but starting with raw, sauteing the pieces of the meat in the shell, getting all the color, taking the meat out of the shell, putting the meat back in the pan, adding the brandy and the Madeira, flaming that. It's like, oh my gosh. But in the process of doing all that, it's going to continue to cook even when you add the sauce to it. So sauced, like shrimp pasta, that's a fast, fast thing. So shrimp pasta is a popular thing. I think maybe the most popular shrimp dish is a cold shrimp dish, and that's shrimp cocktail. And probably everybody has seen getting six shrimp sort of balancing on the outside of a martini glass with cocktail sauce in the center. If the shrimp are cooked with flavor in the water, then it's a fine thing. Fried shrimp is probably the second most popular, just as a guess. I didn't look it up. I don't actually know. If possible, cook shrimp with the shells on. Yes, that still holds the poop chute, and you got to do something about that. But the shells do impart flavor into the shrimp. Now, this can be a challenge, particularly if the finished dish is a hot cooked shrimp dish in a sauce like a shrimp pasta sauce. One of my biggest pet peeves, and I get so mad at the chef groups when they post a picture of, say, shrimp, I'm going to invent the dish, shrimp in tomato thyme cream sauce. And the shrimp has the shells on. I get so angry. And here's why. Because it's a stupid thing to do. You as the customer are going to a restaurant, and the chef is asking you, customer in nice clothes, to do the work of peeling and deveining the shrimp while it's in sauce, in the plate, in the dining room. What a moron. It's a stupid thing to do. And take the stinking tails off too, because nobody wants to eat those. Yes, I've read some post that says the shells can be eaten and they're lovely and crunchy. Great. No thanks. If you can leave the shells on the shrimp when you cook them to then peel them off and use the meat later, that's great. If you're cooking a dish, especially in a restaurant where you don't have time to do that and you want the flavor in the pan. So if you peel your shrimp, save the shells for soup or stock or something. You can clean and devein the shrimp. As you're cooking the shrimp in the pan, you're getting a little bit of shrimp fond, that little bit of shrimp, the water is and the protein is starting to caramelize on the pan. So even though the shrimp shells are not imparting flavor into the shrimp, you're using the fond created in the cooking process to enhance the shrimp flavor in the dish. So it might balance out. And the best part is that you're serving the customer a dish that doesn't require customer's labor to actually be able to eat it. And that's a bonus all the way around. So I mentioned boiling shrimp or shrimp cocktail. Now, obviously, this is going to be salted water, but salted water isn't going to add flavor to the shrimp. And so we can do that with actually pickling spice. Pickling spice is just a bunch of stuff, coriander and mustard seed and bay leaf and cloves and a few, maybe allspice, a few other things in there. But the problem with throwing it in the water, just throwing it in the water, is it's going to be everywhere. And it's going to be one more thing to deal with. The shells, trust me, the shells and the shrimp is more than enough to manage. So make a little, put the 2 tablespoons or so of the pickling spice inside of a coffee filter, fold it up like a little package, tie it with a string or a metal, not a paper clip, you know, those little metal binder clips. It won't rust. And put that in the water. The flavor will come out. You'll contain all of the floaty, spicy bits, and then just makes life easy. Question here remains, how long does it take to cook shrimp? Well, bring the salted water to a rolling boil, and then add the shrimp. Now, be careful, don't splash yourself. Don't splash yourself. So there's a physics problem that I can't answer because I don't know how much water you're heating. I don't know if you're at sea level or at 5,000 feet or 8,000 feet. And the higher you are, the lower the temperature of boiling water. And I don't know how much shrimp's going in that water. So the more shrimp going in the water is going to reduce the amount of temperature substantially or a little bit. So I don't know the answer to that. They cook quickly is what I do know. So if you have, say you have a gallon of water and a pound of shrimp, that's not a whole lot of shrimp. That's 12 to 16 shrimp generally. It's going to take about 2 minutes. 2 minutes, yeah, it doesn't take long at all. If you have a lot of shrimp and a little bit of water, it could take 4 to 5 minutes. So part of our mise en place for cooking, for boiling shrimp is not only do we need the pan of boiling water and the shrimp, we need something called the spider, which doesn't look like a spider at all. Sometimes back a long time ago when you used to buy a wok kit, it would have like a bamboo spatula thing, but the also a brass, like a little, and I can't even describe, it looks like just this brass disc with lots of holes, woven holes into it, like brass wire, and that's used to lift things out of deep frying if you deep fry in a wok. But it's spectacular for lifting pasta out of boiling water and all kinds of other things, including taking shrimp out of boiling water. If you don't have that, put a strainer in the sink. When your shrimp is done, how do I know? I'm going to drain that into the colander. Water can go down the drain. The flavor you're going to get isn't worth reducing to get because by the time you do that, it's going to be too salty to eat. So shrimp water goes down the drain. And then we have a bowl of ice water because we want to stop the shrimp from cooking by putting in ice water. I rarely say time is right as a measure for doneness, but 2 to 5 minutes, depending on the amount of water and shrimp you have and where you are, is more than enough. And in nearly all cases, except for the shrimp cocktail, something's going to happen to that that's going to get hot again and it's going to continue the cooking. So can you eat undercooked shrimp? Absolutely. Do you want to? I don't know. Would you rather risk it and eat overcooked shrimp? Perhaps. It does get rubbery and stringy, and its mouthfeel is less so, but it cooks fast. Those now cooked, cooled, unpeeled, undeveined shrimp are available for all kinds of uses after you peel and devein them. So shrimp salad, that's fun. Maybe something with like a curried yogurt and, almonds would be good. They don't have a lot of flavor, a lot of good crunch. This is a really bold idea with shrimp, a little bit of mint, some cilantro, some tomatoes. No, we've got crunch. I think that's good. Salt and pepper, of course. Maybe a touch. Oh, you know what? Lime juice for that, not lemon juice because of the curry. That would be a good little salad. So the cooked shrimp shells, if you've got a pound of shrimp, don't save the shrimp shells, because unless you eat a pound of shrimp every day, you're not going to get that many shells. And having a little baggie of shrimp shells in your freezer for 6 months to throw them away in 6 months, save the time and do it now. If you have lots of shells, especially raw shells, then that's definitely worth saving for making a stock, shrimp stock, because there will be a lot of flavor there to either turn into some kind of a soup, turn that into a sauce, turn that into a sauce for a shrimp and pasta dish would be good. There's a few ways to deal with your shrimp for various shrimp dishes. Now, Scoffier does cover scallops, but not really very much. He really talks about them more in various hors d'oeuvre kinds of things and not so much as main courses. And there's a lot of I'm not telling you not to be fussy, but there's a lot of fussiness in the scallop dishes. And so you take a clean scallop shell and then pipe Duchess potatoes around the outside, glaze that in the salamander, and then put a little bit of this, put your mushroom sauce on the bottom, put a truffle on top of that, add your scallops on top of that, glaze that again. Okay, there's a lot of work. It probably tastes good, but it's a lot of work. And quite honestly, at home, I'm not interested in doing that. It would be great. It would be awesome. It would be very impressive. But it's a lot of work. So there's so many other things to do with scallops. And getting scallop shells and cleaning scallop shells and storing scallop shells and dealing with the smell of scallop shells is not something I'm interested in doing. So scallops do come. Bay scallops are the little teeny ones, and I have yet to find a single good reason for them to exist. So I'm talking about sea scallops, the big ones. You can get them in, and so big is a relative term. Sometimes they're the size of a nickel, maybe the size of a quarter. I have seen them literally the size of a silver dollar. I've seen them massively huge. They're a lot of fun when they're that big. But in the grocery store, they'll be fairly standardized. And in the grocery freezer, I have had terrible luck with the quality of frozen scallops from the grocer's freezer, like a bag of them. Oh my gosh. Now, that doesn't mean all grocers are terrible and all bags and all grocers are terrible, but my experience wasn't very good and I haven't done it again. Fishmongers are a much better source for scallops. Even possibly your grocery store fish case might be a better choice, because there's a good chance they aren't just thawing bags from the freezer. That's a probably the meat department, but there's a cost to that they don't do. So they might still be selling previously frozen or already still frozen scallops in the case. And there's two ways you can get scallops, wet scallops or dry scallops. If it doesn't say dry, because that's a selling point, you're going to pay more for it, then they're probably wet. So wet is obvious, it's plain, that means they have water. What also that means is that there's, I can't pronounce the chemical, but they sprinkle a chemical on the wet scallops, which causes them to hold on to and absorb from their environment, usually ice or water, more water. So they weigh more when you buy them. So you get fewer per pound. But all that water in the scallop is not a good thing because it's going to screw up getting a good sear on the scallop. It's going to screw up cooking the scallop. So what to do? Well, the what to do is very simple. Take the scallops and lay them out on a sheet pan with maybe three layers of paper towel. And then put three layers of paper towel on top of that. And if you have another sheet pan, you can just rest it on top, cover it with plastic wrap, but let it sit in the refrigerator for overnight, possibly two nights. You may have to change the paper towels depending on how much water comes out of those scallops. But the main thing to do is get the water out of the scallops. So now when we cook them, so the application of heat to a protein means that the protein starts to shrink. When it starts to shrink, the muscle fibers push out the moisture that's in there. So even a perfectly dry ribeye is going to have some moisture in it. Wet scallops that are slightly drier are going to have moisture in them. And don't be fooled by the name. Dry scallops also have moisture inside, just not added moisture. So drying them off gives them a chance to sear nicely. I would not put, this would be a place I would avoid putting dry spice on the outside except for salt and pepper, things like cayenne or if you want to be, hey, this is exciting, watch me. Taco seasoning or curry powder, or chili powder or anything else other than salt and pepper. Mostly what's going to happen is it's either going to burn or it's going to burn and then the water's going to come out and make this into like a burnt gummy paste that doesn't stay on the scallop. There's a high probability you aren't going to get the intended result. It's going to make a bit of a mess and you're going to be angry about it. The better thing to do is cook the scallops with just salt and pepper in a hot pan and then make the accompaniment flavored with the desired spice that you had in mind, and now you got a dish that wins. Scallops can cook pretty quickly. Now, if you ever watched Hell's Kitchen, you've seen that Gordon Ramsay serves the scallop cut in half. So they're meat, it's hard to tell on TV. They look like they're about a quarter of an inch by regular size rounds. And there's at least two reasons for that. One is it facilitates faster cooking and more uniform cooking, and which reduces overcooking. It also reduces the amount of water that's going to come out, which would turn the scallops into little rubber band erasers. And we all know what Gordon's going to do about that. So a good sear in a hot pan, maybe for a minute on the first side and 15 to 20 seconds on the second side, if you slice them thin the way Ramsay does, and then that's a good product. Now, scallops cooked to medium, which will leave them just a teeny, teeny bit translucent if you leave them big, maybe fully cooked or close to it when they're small is fine, and that's how I prefer them. Too much more cooking than that, and the water gets pushed out. They start to get a little bit rubbery. They don't hold the sear because the water washes the sear off. Lots of chefs will say that a scallop that begins to split on the top is overcooked, and that might happen. And so there's an aesthetic thing. But they overcook very rapidly, so it's not a bad idea to cut them in half just to manage temperature, and cooking. Now, earlier in this, I mentioned snails. But nearly always, if you like them, you can get them in a can, and they're already cooked. Garlic butter in a clean snail shell. Pack that stuff in there, cram the snail in there, and bake that thing off. And that's probably the most common way to serve them. And it's really pretty good. Garlic tastes yum. If you find them fresh, and I mean from a vendor, not your garden, blanch them and pull out the snail with a toothpick. Now, we did this at a place. Served them with an herby, garlicky brown sauce, brown beef sauce, with some mashed potatoes. And I got to tell you, it was a really spectacular dish. So, it hasn't escaped me that there is a conspicuous absence of recipes. So, for crab and lobster, melt some butter, make some garlic bread, and for most crab or lobster dinners, that's all you need. For a crab boil, or crab burl in some places, and you know who you are, corn cob, red skin potatoes, maybe a few other things, and that's a dinner. Oh, so a quick thing about the crab. So the crab that you buy is already cooked. It can be taken out of the shell as is, which for a king crab, you probably want a towel because those barbs are very pointy and they don't break very easily. They will cut you before they break. But the meat inside is ready to eat. If you like, you want your crab hot, then you can, I think, well, king crab's big, so baking might be the better way to go when it's and medium-ish heat, 300 degrees till it's warm. The Dungeness that we had, I put in the steamer. I put lots of Old Bay in there so that the steam had some flavor, and it actually did impart some flavor into the meat. But it's not hard to make the meat hot. The thing to keep in mind is since it's fully cooked, anything after that is going to lead to overcooking. So just too hot, and then I used pliers because I don't have crab carters, but it worked. The next chapter is, I'm going to butcher this because my French is awful, relevés and entrees of butcher's meat. Now, this is getting into some of the serious meat cookery, and that's really kind of the main thing. There's more main things, but when we're talking about cooking for restaurants, cooking the meat, that's a big deal. That's the thing. That's why you go to the restaurant. Well, other reasons too. So he's got quite a bit to say about cooking of meat, grilling of meat, managing meat, handling meat, and we're going to get through that as we start getting into main courses. And this is going to be fun. There's a lot here, but it's good stuff, and this is exciting. So I'm looking forward to it. All right, folks, that's going to do it. When I was 5 years old or so, my dad brought home two live Maine lobsters to celebrate my parents' anniversary. Now, I don't recall all the details about that night, but shortly after dinner started, I had a babysitter. And my folks were on the way to the emergency room. Turns out my dad is allergic to shellfish. He didn't know. He found out the hard way. If you aren't allergic to shellfish and fancy a fine Maine lobster dinner, use the link on the show notes page for Lobster Anywhere, anywhere in the contiguous 48 states, that is, for quick delivery of live Maine lobsters. They guarantee overnight delivery, and you can even schedule ahead your shipment if that's something you need to do. Use the link culinarylibertarian.com/lobsteranywhere, that's all one word, and have lobster for dinner tomorrow. As I mentioned, I'll add the link to the crab cake recipe on the show notes page, culinarylibertarian.com/230. Thank you for listening. I appreciate you being here. Now, we know we didn't really talk cooking too much, but I hope you got something out of some shellfish information. Thanks also to my Patreon supporters. There's a chef table video up which relates to the fish episode, but in part also to what I talked about drying scallops. A few weeks ago, we bought some commercial cod, and because it was frozen first, it was a bit wet. So I dried it out, just like I explained for the scallops, and the video shows and explains more about that. I'll add the support tab to the Patreon, also to the show notes page. Have a good week, order your seeds, and I'll see you soon. Music for the Culinary Libertarian podcast is provided by Matthew Bankert at mattbankert.com.